Hello, everyone, and welcome to On Science, a weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk. I'm Adam Cole, a production assistant here. On this week's show, stories about technology. We've got an in-depth look at the robot wars that are raging across the country. We'll hear about doctors using a net of electrodes to look for early signs of autism in infants' brainwaves, and NASA scientists saying goodbye to Spirit, the little rover that helped them look for signs of water on Mars. But first, we'll hear about another vehicle in NASA's fleet. You may not have heard of it, but it's the largest self-propelled land-based vehicle in the world.
The space shuttle carries astronauts up into orbit, but first, workers on the ground have to carry the shuttle to the launch pad. That's because the shuttle, its booster rockets, and its fuel tank are all put together in a tall building several miles away. The fully assembled shuttle is a huge, heavy, and delicate object, and it needs to be transported standing upright. To do this tricky balancing act, NASA relies on a massive beast of a machine called the crawler. The crawler looks like a cross between a flatbed truck and a tank. It guzzles gas, going only 32 feet per gallon. It is the biggest self-powered land vehicle in the world.
If you can picture you're going down your interstate, you have a nice grass median in between you, and you're in a vehicle that actually drives across the entire thing. So you're driving on all four lanes plus the grass in between you.
That's Bill Couch. Only six people are certified to drive the crawler. He's one of them. Not on the interstate, of course, but on the crawler way, a special road to the launch pad about 3.5 miles long.
And the crawler way is constructed such that it can hold and manage 18 million pounds. You drive off the crawler way, you start sinking.
So it will take skill and concentration to move Atlantis to the pad. The drivers will take turns through the night so they stay fresh, because the trip takes hours. The crawler is a slow giant. The speedometer in its cab only goes up to 2 miles per hour. With the shuttle on board, Couch will go far slower than that.
Even driving at 0.8 miles an hour, if you're not paying attention, it will get away from you. So how does it handle? You got to watch it.
Thousands of people will be watching. Shuttle workers are getting special passes to bring their families to view the final rollout. Mark Nappy will be there with his wife and two teenage sons. Nappy is an executive with United Space Alliance, the main shuttle contractor. He's worked with the shuttle program for 26 years. He says as the crawler moves Atlantis out of its hangar, the big white spaceship will be lit up by powerful spotlights.
And the people that haven't seen it before are just going to ooh and ah, because it is just an incredible sight. It's a very large vehicle. And they're very close, so they're going to see a perfect shot of it.
Nappy says the end of the shuttle program is starting to feel real, in part because people are losing their jobs.
That makes it very personal for a lot of us that we've worked in this program for a long time. We worked alongside a lot of these people, and we're laying off a lot of people.
Driver Bill Couch says he doesn't know what's next for him, but after 18 years of working with the crawler, he's gratified that so many people will see the final rollout.
You've known all your life that you've been carrying this big package, this the pride of America. You've been carrying the pride of America on your back the whole time. And now you have the sense that these people standing on the sidelines are actually getting to see what we do.
He expects this last trip to the pad to feel familiar, but it will be different.
It's a bittersweet feeling. You hate to see anything come to an end. You're breaking up your family. You're going to miss the people.
Couch says when the shuttle is safely at the launch pad, an event known as hard down, the close-knit crawler team always has a little ritual.
We open up a bag of chips and salsa, and there it is.
And so you think for the last one it will still be chips and salsa, or is anybody thinking about like a cake? Or I assume you wouldn't drink champagne on the crawler.
No champagne. But it will probably be the same ceremony we have done for every other hard down, as we will have our chips and salsa.
Then they'll back up the crawler and drive away, leaving the space shuttle behind. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
The crawler's last shuttle rollout was a historic event for NASA, and a very personal one for its crew. But the shuttle program isn't the only mission coming to an end with a bittersweet mix of emotions. NASA announced it will no longer listen for a signal from Spirit, one of the 2 6-wheeled rovers that landed on Mars in 2004. Spirit was supposed to run for 90 days. In fact, it lasted more than 6 years. Joe Palca has this remembrance.
On landing day 2004, there was a powerful mix of anticipation and anxiety in the rover control room at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Everything was looking good, but space missions, especially missions to Mars, have a way of failing at the last minute. Lots can go wrong when you have to go from 10,000 miles per hour to a dead stop in 6 minutes, but everything worked.
When we landed, the view was spectacular, and everybody was very excited about the successful engineering achievement.
Jim Bell, now at Arizona State University, was in charge of the main cameras on the rover.
What wasn't so clear was that there was a lot of sort of scientific disappointment.
Disappointment because NASA sent Spirit to Mars to search for signs of water, and the rocks near the landing site were all made in a bone-dry environment. Not far from the landing site were some interesting-looking hills.
We could see them 3 kilometers off in the distance, and it's kind of a wistful feeling. It's like, wow, look at that. It looks like some really cool geology up there, but man, it's 3 kilometers away. We're never going to get there. There's no way the rover's going to survive to go that far. And of course, none of us ever imagined we'd be sitting on top of that peak off in the distance in the not-too-distant future.
That's because the coffee-table-sized rover far exceeded everyone's expectations. Bell says once in the hills, the science started getting exciting. There were signs that volcanic lava mixed with water to form an array of minerals.
One gets a sort of a mental picture of a Yellowstone-like environment on this part of Mars, 3 billion years ago or more. And by our reckoning on this planet, that's a habitable environment.
At first, it wasn't certain Spirit would even make it through the scheduled 90 days. This report was on All Things Considered just 3 weeks after landing.
NASA's Mars rover Spirit is sick, and it may not fully recover.
There was a serious problem with the onboard computer, but NASA engineers on Earth, millions of miles away, were able to send commands that restored the computer to perfect health. 2 years later, All Things Considered reported on another danger looming for Spirit and its twin rover Opportunity.
Both are showing clear signs of age, and as NPR's Joe Palca reports, the extreme cold of a Martian winter could spell their doom.
But both made it through that winter. Over the years, mission managers became very attached to the rovers. Mission manager John Callis shared these thoughts in 2006.
They see, they move, they interact, they respond to our commands, and they think on their own. And so they are very much like, living creatures. And we've become very fond of them. I know I've become very fond of the rovers.
For team members, the rovers became a fixture in their lives. Albert Haldeman was deputy mission scientist in 2006.
We're used to waking up every day and seeing the latest from the rovers, and they're always there every day, day in, day out. And if one day that stops being the case, it's going to be very sad.
Now that day has come. In anticipation of a fourth winter on Mars, engineers put Spirit in a kind of deep hibernation mode in March of last year, hoping it would wake up with spring. But it hasn't. John Grant is a planetary scientist with the Smithsonian Institution and a member of the rover science team.
There was a sense that they've overcome so much in the past that we'd hear from her again. And when that didn't happen, well, maybe this had happened and they'll keep trying another way. And I guess a sense of denial, but also a very deep sense of loss that we're not going to hear from Spirit again.
Spirit may be gone, but there's still one rover left. Opportunity is still chugging along. Although scientists know one day it will go silent too. Joe Palca, NPR News.
There isn't a blood test or a brain scan that can identify a child with autism. But scientists are trying to change that using technology that can detect unusual electrical signals in the brain. The approach could help diagnose autism earlier, and, as John Hamilton reports, it's also providing hints about which therapies are likely to help.
Research shows that kids with autism do better if they start getting therapy before age 2. But Charles Nelson, a professor of pediatrics at Harvard, says that rarely happens.
Right now, the earliest we can reliably identify a child is, say, 3 years of age. We've now lost 3 years of time to do an intervention. our work is designed to see, can we do that in early infancy, long before any signs or symptoms of autism are apparent in the child's behavior?
Nelson is part of a team that's studying the brains of autistic children using electroencephalography, or EEG. The technology records the electrical signals produced by brain cells. Nelson says kids wear a sort of hairnet that holds several dozen electrodes against their scalp.
Once that's on, the child can either sit on a parent's lap or sit in a chair by themselves if they're old enough,
while a computer analyzes the signals coming from their brain. William Basel of Children's Hospital Boston says the goal has been to find some kind of pattern in those signals that indicates autism.
So what we're looking for then are markers or features in the signals that will tell us something about the brain as it develops and differences in development.
And they've found at least one promising marker. It involves very high-frequency brainwaves known as gamma oscillations. Basel and Nelson have been studying those oscillations in about 80 children from the time they were 6 months old. Nelson says some of the kids are at high risk for developing autism because they have an older sibling with the disorder. The rest have no special risk factors.
What we've observed is that starting as young as 6 months, maybe even younger, infants who have a high risk for developing autism show dramatic reductions in gamma activity. So they show less gamma activity than do children who have no risk or a very low risk for developing the disorder.
That suggests EEG could help identify very young children who will go on to develop autism. But the researchers won't know for sure until the children in their study reach the age when the disorder becomes obvious. In the meantime, other research using EEG is revealing how autism affects the brain and how intervening early might make a difference. Sophie Mulholm of Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York has been studying how autism impairs the brain's ability to integrate information from the senses. She says a typical brain does this with ease.
We walk through the world and our sensory systems are continuously presented with stimulation, visual stimulation, auditory stimulation, touch, smells, and we very automatically put this information together to make sense of the world and to navigate it.
For example, when a person is listening to someone at a noisy cocktail party, they'll focus on that person's face, and their brain will automatically combine what they see with what they hear. But Mulholm says people with autism often have trouble doing this.
So we set up a very simple version of this where we present words and noise.
Words like bear.
Bear.
Mulholm played the words for children with autism as well as typical children. At times, the audio was accompanied by a video of a person saying the word. At other times, it wasn't. Mulholm wanted to know whether the brains of children with autism react differently than other kids' brains. And they do.
What we find is that children with autism don't benefit from the visual signal nearly as much as do typically developing children.
And research using EEG indicates that's because their brains are having trouble integrating what they're seeing with what they're hearing. Mulholm says the surprising thing is that the brains of kids with autism seem to get much better at this integration when they become teenagers.
The beauty of that finding is it suggests that the neural circuitry to do this is there, it's intact, but it's just not coming online during the earlier childhood years.
Mulholm says that neural circuitry might come online sooner if these children were diagnosed early and encouraged to practice watching faces while listening to words. John Hamilton, NPR News.
To inspire the next generation of scientists, a group of small manufacturers around the country are encouraging kids to build robots. And not just any robots. These are robot gladiators. Chris Arnold has the story.
For a lot of kids in high school, robots are pretty cool. And of course, gladiators are pretty cool too. So what could possibly be cooler than robot gladiators?
Okay, let's get ready for fight number two. And three. Two, one, let it rip.
It's a Saturday morning, and 100 high school students from around the country have met in an airplane hangar in Indianapolis for a robot battle. These competitions are held from time to time in different cities. Each school team brings robots that they've built. They don't look like mechanical people, more like remote control cars, but with spinning metal blades and other weapons attached to them. They weigh about 15 pounds. The robots fight inside an 8-foot-high bulletproof glass cage. The students drive using controls from outside. Local business owner Steve Overton is announcing the match.
Down. Oh, that was a big hit.
The bulletproof glass is actually a good idea, since these little robots really tear each other up and send chunks of metal flying in all directions. One robot, named Armageddon, smashes its opponent, it's named Steel Raptor, with a spinning hammer-type weapon, and it goes flying 6 feet in the air.
Steel Raptor is completely banged up.
Steel Raptor is finally looking completely dead, and the match is over.
Once you got him,
yeah, baby, yes.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys, so you did some damage in that one there, it looked like. Huh? A little more than I expected.
Our team name, Slinger Bots Club, from Slinger, Wisconsin.
Now, plenty of Americans have unusual hobbies, but there's a greater goal in the background here. The organizers are trying to get young people interested in high-tech manufacturing.
Manufacturing's not a smokestack industry anymore. What we do is cool.
Grady Cope is the chairman of the National Tooling and Machining Association, which sponsors this robot fight league. He owns his own manufacturing company outside of Denver.
We don't have any incoming young people into our businesses, and our businesses are all ready to grow right now. And one of the things we've really wanted to do was find a way to attract kids back to the engineering and manufacturing environment.
To get help building the robots, high school and some college students match up with local manufacturers. And so they get to see inside of a modern manufacturing shop. Many have big computer-controlled robotic machines that make parts for all kinds of stuff. Jet engines, racing bicycles, medical tools for surgery. And these businesses need workers who are good with their hands and who are also good with math and can program and operate these kind of machines.
I'm Anna. I'm from Lincoln Sudbury, and I'm 15.
Anna Zolnikoff is the driver of one of her team's robots, and she probably had the most dramatic hit of the day, knocking out an opponent in about 3 seconds. Right now, she's working on another robot in the pit crew area.
I'm fixing my robot, which was one of its teeth was knocked off in a fight. So I'm putting them all back together.
And overall, the effort here seems to be working. At the next table over, Dakota Cleaver is a high school senior from Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. He says he's going to be going to college next year to study high-tech engineering.
When I came into high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do, but getting to do this definitely got me interested in the engineering aspect of things.
But first, he has to get his robot, named Excessive Force, ready for its next battle. It has a big steel and bronze lobster-like claw hanging off of one side of it. Chris Arnold, NPR News. Because you know that.
And that's all for this week's Science Podcast. You can find all the stories you heard today at npr.org/sciencepodcast. I'm Adam Cole. Have a great week. But you